Matthew.
And I'm Molly.
And this is Spilled Milk, the show where we cook something delicious, eat it all, and you can't have any.
Today, we are talking about chef techniques.
And this episode was suggested by listener Brandon, who has suggested a couple of really good episode topics before, and also is waiting for us to do fried chicken, which we really need a guest in order to do. Yeah. But we will get to that at some point.
We will.
And some of the techniques, I will identify some of the questions below, come from Brandon's suggestions of chef techniques that he would like us to talk about.
Mm, okay, great.
I thought this would be fun if we do use these techniques. If we don't, you know.
Yeah. It's going to be so fun. I can't wait.
Okay. So let's go down memory lane. When you hear the term chef techniques or chefy techniques, which I wasn't sure quite which one to call the episode, what do you think of?
Well, I mean, first I think of working in restaurants.
Sure.
I have worked in two restaurants. I worked in Greens, vegetarian restaurant in San Francisco. I was an intern there one of the summers that I was in college. I should also say I was not even there for the full summer. I discovered I hate working in restaurants, and I think I only stayed for maybe 6 or 8 weeks or something.
That's a long time still.
And then the other restaurant I worked in was the one I owned, and I still hated cooking in restaurants, but I did it for 4 months, and you were like the salad person? Yeah, so I was explaining this to June the other day. I was like, Dad made the pizzas, and I did everything else. And June was like, whoa! And I was like, no.
Is that literally what they said?
Yes. No, June was like, wow. And then before I could even say anything.
Did they say wow or whoa?
Before I could even say anything, June kind of like did the math and was like, oh, wait, everything else on the menu is like salads or like cold starters and desserts. So, you know, to be clear, that station requires a lot of prep and then like plating of things.
Sure.
But not so much actual
use of heat.
And
we're going to talk about prep and plating.
So, and in addition to that, of course, like I think a lot of what I know I learned from watching the Food Network, like starting when I was in high school, like maybe my senior year of high school, I think I started geeking out on the Food Network.
Me too.
And then, of course, a whole lot of books.
David Rosengarten's Taste.
Yes. God, that was my favorite.
Oh, like, it's my favorite too.
Hands down, favorite.
And, I can't remember her name. Sarah
Moulton.
Yes, of course.
You had a crush on Sarah Moulton.
Of course.
Yeah. No, she's very cute.
Still do.
I wanted to say, too, that I feel like when I was growing up, there were many more like sort of chef technique books that were like in my parents' collection than are in my own. So, for instance, Julia Child's The Way to Cook.
Oh, yeah.
Which I actually have a copy of and treasure.
Do you have La Russe Gastronomie?
I don't. I don't.
That was always, I'm sure my mom still has it, and it was always on the shelf. And like, it was the kind of book, like, I would pull it out, like, this looks interesting. What the fuck is this?
Yeah, no, it was not, like, a fun read. I mean, unless you were that kind of
I was talking to someone recently about how we had like a like late 60s edition of this Encyclopedia Britannica that had like red leatherette binding and or like burgundy colored.
Yeah.
And I would absolutely read the encyclopedia for fun.
Oh, yeah. No, that is a favorite pastime.
Yeah.
The other person who I really associate with these books on like chefy technique is James Peterson.
Mm.
Do you remember him?
Yes, of course. So sauces.
Yep.
What else? Like, yeah, like a French cookbook.
Yep. And they were always very like heavily illustrated, you know, with like all the steps. Kind of like, I mean, for like current day cookbook readers, think of like Kenji Lopez Alt's books, right? James Peterson. I keep wanting to say James Patterson.
Yeah.
Different author.
Yep.
James Peterson was doing that kind of like step-by-step illustrated stuff. But in more like classical French technique.
Yeah, it's like Alex Cross dismantles a chicken. Is that a James Patterson character? It's what came to mind. It was a great joke.
You're so happy about this joke. You're just sitting there grinning. Anyway, I remember when James Peterson, I don't even know if he's still living.
I don't know. Let's see if we can find out.
But anyway, I remember when some of his like tomes came out how important they really felt for anyone who was interested in cooking. It seemed like you had to know this stuff.
James Peterson is an American writer and cookery teacher. He studied chemistry at the University of California at Berkeley. His first book, Sauces, came out in 1990. So
there
yeah,
we go.
I'm so glad you brought that. I've not thought about James Peterson in too long. There were a couple things I used to cook from his French cookbook.
Mm. I think my dad had had sauces. And then I think I had a couple of books that came later, but
you
I no longer
else?
Have them because I just didn't use them.
James Peterson had a smaller book called The Duck Cookbook. And there were like duck leg recipes that I would make because like I started getting there was this recipe in the New York Times that called for duck legs and I started getting really into cooking duck legs and then I got the James
Peterson
book.
This is like a late 90s thing.
Uh-huh. Or, early 2000s, I think.
Mm-hmm. The duck era.
For me, the author that I associate with Chefy Techniques is Michael Ruhlman,
yes. Of
course. And mm-hmm. so especially the books, The Making of a Chef and The Soul of a Chef. The Making of a Chef is about like a year in the life of students at the Culinary Institute of America.
I read that one.
Soul of a Chef is like three like extended essays, the most memorable one being about the Certified Master Chef exam.
I skipped that book.
The Certified Master Chef exam part is wild. I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
And like they're like doing just things that never need to happen, like making a ballotine, which if I remember correctly, is like you bone a chicken and then you like take the skin of the chicken, which you've removed without tearing it, and like make a football shaped like thick concoction.
Is this like a French turducken?
It's like a French turducken, yeah. but it's like it's a chick chuckin. So doing things like that, and I loved reading about all of these things that I knew I would never ever do myself.
It's so interesting. I mean, there was a time when I loved reading all of that stuff.
Me too.
And I found it really interesting, and somehow I just got like super turned off of and tired of chef culture. It's not that I was ever that interested in chef culture, but somehow it felt entertaining for a while.
You know, for me, I think it's that Fast and Furious movies have replaced that for me. That like, okay. You know, I don't even drive a car, let alone race a car, mm-hmm. but I do love watching people do it in a movie.
You know, speaking of which, Matthew, we should just let everybody know that for our paying subscribers, we recently did a bonus episode.
That's right.
On Fast X or Fast 10.
Yeah. We forced Molly to watch it, and the results were kind of exactly what you'd expect.
Yep. Okay. Well, okay. So let's go through this list of like sort of chefy techniques and talk about whether we do them or don't do them and why,
et cetera. Yeah. I made the list, and I'm sure there are a million things that I left off. So if you think of any like during this that you want to add, go ahead. Listeners, if you think of any and want to like write in at contact@spilledmilkpodcast.com, maybe we'll like revisit this as a segment at some point.
Sure, sure. I'm going to put on chapstick. Would you please introduce the first chefy technique?
I put on some chapstick earlier today. It was a very fruity flavored one.
Ooh.
Mm. Okay, the first five are from listener Brandon.
Okay.
Do you mise en place?
Yes.
Me too.
I do. I feel like a mise en place. I think all of our listeners know what this means, but basically this means preparing, measuring out, and making available, like within arm's reach, all of your ingredients before you really begin cooking.
Yeah, I find this so satisfying and it's so stressful to cook without doing it that
way. Absolutely. I always do a mise en place and I don't even think about it. I think it's just, if you cook enough, it really feels obvious that you need to do this.
Oh, I thought of one to add to the list.
Okay.
Number two, also from listener Brandon, do you pay attention to plating?
Absolutely not.
I would say for me, absolutely not, like 95% of the time.
Okay.
And then occasionally when I plate something like semi-nicely, my family is like, whoa, look at that.
Would this be like if you were making duck, for instance?
If I was making duck, for instance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, if it's like bistro night. We did the bistro night episode. If I had like a leg of duck confit and like a little salad that like nestles in the crook of the duck leg and like, I don't know, mashed potatoes or something. Like when you've got like meat and two veg that you can like arrange nicely on the plate, or like a piece of fish on top of a salad.
Okay. Well, I have to say one thing. Number one, for my birthday this year,
ooh,
would you make me bistro night?
Yeah.
I
would love to.
Okay. I want
that for
my birthday.
Do you want me to like come to your house?
No. I'll come to your house.
Okay.
I mean, unless you want to come to my house, but I think you'd probably prefer cooking in your own house.
I think so.
Okay. Hold on. The other thing I want to say is, I mean, I think the reason that I don't ever pay attention to plating is that we always serve dinner family style.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's like a Dutch oven full of soup or whatever, I let everybody serve themselves.
We and usually so, do it that yeah. way, but not always.
Yeah. And I think some of it is, I mean, some of it, I think for me has been really intentional in the sense of like letting my kid decide how much
oh, yeah,
of things
absolutely.
They want. So I think that's part of why I have never really cared about plating, because I really want everybody to have the like agency to choose how much they're eating.
I like that. Yeah. But then everyone is responsible for creating a beautiful plate that they've served up themselves, and you have to approve it.
That's right. That's how it works.
Okay, next, velveting food, especially in Asian cuisine.
So I'm gonna say, honestly, that I did not know what velveting meat was until my friend Joe was telling me about how he makes like stir-fried beef with broccoli at home. And
yeah,
I was like,
so
what?
You like put some like egg white in there and then pass it through oil quickly and then stir-fry it. Like the egg white is not always part of it, but that's basically the idea.
Hold on. Can you explain, like, so in the context of like beef and broccoli, what would you do with the beef? So you'd have these like sort of thin pieces of beef.
Yeah. And you toss that with some like egg white, cornstarch, salt or soy sauce.
Yep.
And then heat enough oil that you're like shallow frying and like blanch it in that oil, drain it. And then stir fry those pieces.
Ah,
so it gets very has a very like you know, it's tender and has like kind of a smooth, slippery kind of texture.
Okay. And I think that this is like really essential to what we think of as the texture of something like beef and broccoli.
Yeah, I almost never do it because I'm too lazy. My grandfather, who loved cooking Chinese food, was a big proponent of velveting.
Okay. I'm surprised that you don't do it. I mean, it seems...
Yeah, you're right. I should.
I mean, it does seem annoying to, like, do this shallow frying. I mean, neither you nor I have a real, like, functional exhaust fan.
Right.
And so...
You know what I recently got? So in preparation for what's sure to be, like, horrific wildfire smoke later this summer, we got an air purifier.
Ooh.
Like the one that Wirecutter recommends that,
yeah.
That
we're
seems
about
like
to
everyone
order it,
has.
Actually.
Yep.
Yep.
And I was making burgers the other day, and I was like, ooh, I am going to test this out on burger smoke. And so, like, I put it on, like, the light turned red, saying, like bad air quality, and then it went to purple and then to blue over the course of, like, 30 minutes. And then everyone was like, wow, it doesn't even, like, smell like burgers in here
anymore.
Oh, my
God, I'm totally going to buy this thing.
Yeah.
Wow. Matthew, I don't know if I've told you, but so we have an air purifier. I'm not convinced that it works super well. I don't even remember, like, what the brand is. I'm not going to name names, but we have tried passing gas over it to see what happens.
And
I was able to turn it red. I'm really proud of myself.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
I think the thing about them is they like the basic one you get like doesn't cover a very large square footage.
Yeah, and we need to get a better one.
Yeah, or multiples.
Yeah. Okay. All right. What's the next one?
Homemade mayo/aioli.
All right. There was a period in my life when I made homemade mayo.
I've seen you do it. We did a mayo episode.
And I think that when we did the mayo episode, I mean, it was way back, right?
Like, yeah.
Probably within the first 50 episodes. I'm pretty sure I had not yet had children.
I think it was later than that, but let's find out.
So I usually, I mean, I made a lot of mayo working in restaurants, for sure. Or like catering, doing catering gigs. I made a lot of mayo.
You're not going to believe this.
When was it?
Episode 369,
really?
January 2019.
No way.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I find mayo to be really satisfying and easy to make. That said, I don't often make it. I am really happy with Best Foods mayo.
Yeah, I've never done it, except like I stood next to you like the time you did it in my kitchen, and you did it with great confidence, and I was very impressed, and I certainly haven't done it since then.
And I should say I've always found aioli a bit tricky because even the mildest olive oil can create bitterness. So yeah, I find aioli tricky, and I would like to better understand how to make aioli, but I probably won't need to for another 20 years or so.
Yeah, you might have to go back to France and like study at like,
yeah, that sounds good.
Université d'Oli. homemade stocks.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Okay. Homemade stocks are something I still do, but I don't like go out of my way to like buy ingredients to make it. It's more like if we have a roasted chicken, I'm going to save all the various stuff that we don't eat and the bones and whatnot and throw it in like the Instant Pot with carrot, onion, celery, maybe whatever herbs we have around. And like let her rip.
I do not make homemade stocks hardly ever. It was a thing where I just had to kind of let it go and admit that I'm not going to be the homemade stock person, even though I want to think of myself as the homemade stock boy. I'm a stock boy.
Some of the dishes that we use like better than bouillon in, I think they taste more to our liking with better than bouillon than with
so happy when I discovered that my favorite risotto is risotto made with a Knorr bouillon cube.
Yeah. 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 I do want to say that once, and this was definitely pre-children, for New Year's, we had some friends over. I was married to Brandon. We had some friends over and I made this recipe that was in Gourmet magazine, which it was still in existence at the time.
Okay.
Maybe this was like New Year's 2008 or New Year's 2009.
Oh, like just and before we started the show.
They had a recipe for like scallops in like a creme fraiche, almost like consomme type thing. I mean, I'm not describing it well, but basically what it had you do.
Like a really sour consomme.
No, what it had you do was basically make a fish stock using whatever white fish you could get parts from at your fishmonger. And I remember I went and I got like halibut fins and stuff like that.
Me too.
Because you can totally do that at like these great fish markets we have around here. I went and I got like these big, gorgeous, like sort of off cuts from halibut, and I made a fish broth. It smelled so good. And basically all I had to do was take some of that. And I think I like whisked some creme fraiche into it and maybe a little something else. And that was kind of like the base for then like some seared scallops. It was incredible.
I also had the experience, like, I think just one time of making fish stock. I went down to like Pure Food Fish and said, just give me like some stuff for making fish stock. I felt like on the way home when I had this bag of like assorted fish parts, I felt like I was coming back from like a murder. Mm-hmm. And then when I got home and like put this all in the pot, like, this looks terrifying. Like, is this really going to be edible? And it was so good. I think I was making fish chowder.
I feel like fish stock is one of those things that is so much more than the sum of its parts, even more than chicken stock. Like, there's something that makes you feel really chefy about making fish stock.
Absolutely. Okay. Do you do these things? Do you wash dishes while cooking?
Yes. Yes, I do.
I give myself like a C minus on this.
This was something my dad taught me, that you should always clean up as you go. So whenever I have a break in a recipe, I try to always do all the dishes that have accumulated up to that point.
Yeah, if there's something with a good break, like, then I will use the break for that, especially if I'm listening to a podcast. If it's something where there isn't like a defined break, like, you know, when I've seen real chefs cook, they will do it anyway somehow. I will not.
Okay. Okay.
Do you flip food in a skillet or wok with a confident flip of the wrist without using a spatula? So you're like throwing the food up in the air and it all comes down into the pan.
Nope.
Every once in a while, I will do this on a very small scale, like with some like potatoes that I'm sauteing or something.
Ash can do it with fried eggs, but sometimes it breaks the yolk.
Yeah.
But
I bet it looks cool.
It does look really cool. It's hot.
Okay. Do you sous vide?
Absolutely not.
Me neither. Never have. Do you flambé?
Only for the show.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's so
like
fun.
Bananas Foster.
We should make that again.
God, it was so
good.
Hey, maybe we could have that after bistro night.
That's a great idea. And we can like set the fire next to the air purifier.
Yes. Woo.
Do you clarify butter?
Absolutely not.
I have, like, at least occasionally. I don't know why.
You once clarified the butter that you used to brush on a grilled cheese you made for me.
What?
I know.
What?
I was like, what? Or no, maybe it was just that you melted it. And now I always melt the butter too, but No.
I did melt. I think I've been slandered.
I remember my parents. So when I was growing up and my parents would cook artichokes, we would always eat them with what my mother called drawn butter and lemon.
Right.
And drawn butter would be clarified butter.
Okay.
I don't really choose to eat my artichokes that way now. Mm-hmm. I like them dipped in mayo with mustard and lemon mixed in.
Yeah, that's not going to be me.
Okay.
Do you ever use impressive amounts of butter? Right, like, you know, like one of the secrets of restaurant cooking is they use like awesome amounts of butter or olive oil that you would feel weird doing at home.
No, I wouldn't say that I use impressive amounts of butter by restaurant standards, but I do think that, especially running a restaurant and knowing a number of chefs, I think that I feel more comfortable cooking with a good amount of olive oil and butter than I think a lot of my like fellow like white American cooks.
Sure. The other day, so the reason I thought of this one is that December's pick of the week was this recipe from friend of the show, Just One Cookbook. Mm-hmm. For garlic steak rice.
Mm.
And it's a dish where you make sort of like a fried rice, like a crisped rice that has a lot of butter and garlic in it. And you also like use a lot of butter to cook the steak. And like, as I was making this, I was like, oh, this dish, it's called garlic butter steak or garlic steak rice because it has, wait, there's no, the word butter isn't in there. Anyway, this is good because it has so much butter in it, and it was delicious.
Oh my God. Okay.
So I'm going to be making that again.
Okay. I want to make it. Would you send me the recipe?
Yeah, the rice gets a little bit crispy, ooh, but like, you know, kind of browned butter crispy. Very satisfying.
Oh my God. You need to send me this recipe. Yeah. I think my people would like it.
Spherification.
You must be kidding.
I've seen someone do it, like in like live.
Yeah, I mean, I think that used to be a thing.
Yeah, I think it's still a thing that some chefs do sometimes.
For sure.
Do you ever use liquid nitrogen in the kitchen?
No.
I wish I did. I love liquid nitrogen. It's so cool.
Liquid nitrogen ice cream is really incredible. Yeah. So smooth.
Do you ever break down a whole chicken or fillet a fish?
I have broken down a whole chicken. I'm not very good at it, but I have broken down a whole chicken and I will do it. And I don't think I filleted a fish. That seems almost harder to me, or like removing the skin from a fish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I have definitely filleted a fish a few times. Fish differ a lot in like how easy it is to fillet them. So I filleted like a mackerel, which is a very easy fish to fillet.
By fillet, what do you mean exactly?
So take a whole fish and like remove like two or four, but in my case, the fish I'm kind of talking about, two boneless flat pieces from one from each side.
Okay. Okay.
Leaving behind something that looks like something that like Heathcliff would pull out of a garbage can.
Yeah. No, I don't think I've ever done that.
Breaking out a chicken, I will do maybe like once a year. Mm-hmm. Like there's this particular like Malaysian style braised chicken or chicken and rice dish that I make that starts with a whole chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And I can do it every time I feel like I'm going to do it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not something that I feel a strong need to master. I feel like I can do it well enough.
Yeah. Cooking without following a recipe.
I do it all the time.
All the time.
All the time. That said, I use a lot of recipes.
Yeah, me too.
But I have a lot of basic things I can do without ever opening a recipe.
Okay, like what are a couple of them?
Like beans and escarole.
Mm-hmm.
Don't need a recipe.
Yeah.
Of course, anything involving eggs.
Yep.
Fried rice. I really don't need a recipe for fried rice, though sometimes I will remind myself of the amount of like seasoning that I like in it. Let's see here. What else? Oh, God. So much stuff. Vinaigrette.
Yeah.
Roasted vegetables, literally everything I do with roasted vegetables.
Sure.
Everything I do with salad. I don't even know the last time I ever followed a salad recipe. Burgers.
Yeah, this is good stuff.
Roasted salmon.
Oh, yeah.
Don't need a recipe for that. What else?
Oh, yeah. So things I do without, like the things that came to mind for cooking without a recipe, like improvising a braise or a stir fry.
Okay.
I'll do that all the time.
Okay.
Deglazing a pan.
I have deglazed a few pans in my day, but
me too.
I don't feel like I do a lot of cooking that requires deglazing a pan.
No, me neither. Making a roux.
Yes, oh, I have.
Okay.
So I think of, I'm going to say, actually, I'm going to alter this a little bit. And maybe you will say that this is not making a roux, but
I think I know what you're going to say.
I'm going to say bechamel. So,
that's absolutely making a roux.
Okay. So yeah, basically like melting butter.
Or basically.
Melting butter, adding a little bit of flour, just keeping it blonde, and then adding milk. I made a souffle maybe like a year ago or something, and I hadn't made one for a long time. And I used to feel really confident making souffles and making bechamel. I did something wrong in making the bechamel. And I think what I did was I overcooked the flour.
Oh.
And the bechamel like would not thicken. Like it would never thicken. And I wound up having to throw it out. June remembers it very well because I was like completely mystified. I was like, what have I done wrong?
Were you standing in the kitchen with like a lost expression on your face?
I was so frustrated. Oh, yeah. Wasted so much, or it felt like a big waste. It wasn't that big a waste.
So when I also thought of bechamel, which I've only ever made for making like a lasagna bolognese.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, which doesn't really count as making a roux, but is kind of similar, is like sometimes when I'm making a stew or braise, I will like saute some like mirepoix or vegetables and then throw in like a tablespoon of flour and cook that up with them a little bit before I add the liquid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great.
Blanching vegetables.
You know, occasionally. If I'm feeling, I don't know, if I'm feeling like I've got a lot of time on my hands, when I make Sichuanese rice with beef or beef with celery and rice.
Yeah, yeah.
So the recipe that I usually follow comes from one of Fuchsia Dunlop's books, and it recommends, chopping the celery and then blanching it really quickly and draining it before you then stir fry it with beef and chili bean paste.
And I think I usually do
stuff.
That.
I have definitely skipped the blanching, but it's so easy. I mean, you can even blanch it in the wok. I mean, as you would learn from Kenji Lopez Alt's The Wok, you can do like all of those things in a wok, right?
That's true.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Do I blanch? I definitely think of blanching vegetables as like a thing that I would have read about in a chef cookbook more than a thing I would do at home. Not that it's hard. It's just like what's the point of blanching vegetables? It's like getting like retaining the color or something.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I think I would be more inclined to like do a long cooked, like boiled vegetable, like Italian style or something,
right,
than I am to blanch things these days.
Do you make charcuterie or cure meats?
Absolutely not. But there was a time when I would have wanted to.
Yeah, same here. For years and years now, I've been saying that I want to make another homemade corned beef, which is something I most recently did probably in like, I don't know, 2004 or something.
I thought you made one for the show.
Did I make one for the show?
I think you might have made one for the show.
So yeah, so maybe 2010, because it would have been for our like Irish Spring episode, which I think was episode 3, something like that.
Something.
So I haven't done it since then, but homemade corned beef is so good.
Mm-hmm.
It is really so much better than like a store-bought corned beef, which is also pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So... Mm-hmm. You know what? It's like going down and like asking for them to like trim a brisket for me and knowing that it's going to cost probably like $70 and like, but yeah, I need to just like do it.
Yeah.
Do you make pâtés and forcemeats?
So I, back when I had a column in Bon Appetit.
Oh, right.
The premise of it is that at least the majority of the time I was cooking things that I was not super familiar with cooking. So I was kind of like trying to sort of overcome some hurdles. So I think I really taught myself to make mayonnaise for that column.
Oh. So you would say, would you say that this column is like force meat to get out of my rut?
But another thing I did was I made like a country pâté,
a French country pâté.
And I think I chose it because I knew that it was a little bit more within my comfort zone to make like a country pâté as opposed to like a mousse pâté, because I'm scared of touching chicken livers.
Sure.
Although I love a chicken liver mousse.
Yeah.
When somebody else makes it.
Yeah, no, like I've bought chicken livers like in a plastic tub, and like opening that tub and seeing like a tub full of chicken livers is
There's
challenging.
There's chicken liver in my family's beloved Thanksgiving stuffing recipe. Sure. And I would not leave out the chicken liver, but I'm always like, Mom, would you please come over and deal with the chicken liver?
Yeah.
Anyway, so I made country pate, and, you know, like in a tureen, pork and whatnot. And it's very easy. It's really easy.
Sure.
I do think I had to make it like three times to really get it exactly to my liking. And I've never made it again.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've never done it at all.
Yeah.
Pickling.
Oh, yeah. Pickling. I've pickled a little bit. My ex-husband is a big pickler.
Big pickler.
Big pickler. And so I don't feel a strong need to pickle myself.
I generally make the same kind of pickle over and over, which is like I slice a Persian cucumber or two and like toss that with salt, sugar, white vinegar, and Korean gochugaru chili flakes. That's my favorite pickle, and I make it all the time.
And do you use it like right away? Do you need to let it sit for a little while?
It needs to sit for at least a little while, but like same day is fine, and it's better the next day and good for up to like 3 or 4 days.
I love, you know, that just like super old school cucumber salad. It's like cucumber and either white or like rice vinegar mm-hmm. with sugar and a little bit of salt and like some fresh dill. Oh my God. It's served really cold in the summer. Nothing could be better.
Do you pass things through a tammy or chinois?
Absolutely not. I love that you asked.
And that's the last one on my list. Did you think of any others?
Do you have a chinois?
Oh yeah. Like I'm constantly like, you know, I feel like I have passed through a tammy over the last few years.
And we all have.
Come out smoother and less grainy.
Okay.
So the answer is no.
Okay, great. Matthew.
Yeah.
I've got a now but wow.
Oh, let's hear it.
Okay. As I mentioned in a recent subscriber newsletter, mm-hmm. so if you're a paying subscriber, you got this newsletter, I have been really interested in learning more about loose leaf black teas. And a lot of what I have been purchasing and enjoying, I learned about from actually the food writer Marion Bull,
okay.
who writes for a lot of different publications. She's also a ceramicist, mm-hmm. But I love her newsletter, which is called Mess Hall.
Oh, nice.
Anyway, she wrote a piece earlier this year about getting into black teas, and she linked to a couple different producers or, you know, distributors of teas that she really likes. And one of the ones that she mentioned was a really great everyday black tea sold by Nepali Traders.
Okay.
And it is their Himalayan Golden Black Tea. And we'll link to it in the show notes. According to the Nepali Traders website, it is picked during the monsoon season in Sandakfu. I don't know how to pronounce this. Do you think I'm doing this wrong?
I don't have an opinion.
Great. Okay. Well, it's picked during the monsoon season in this region of Nepal. Its rich, deep amber liquor has notes of malt, clover, honey, and burnt sugar, highlighted by aromatic notes of apricot and clove. It is a great breakfast tea that can be enjoyed with or without milk and sugar. It was awarded the best black tea by the North American Tea Championship.
Nice.
I have been really enjoying this tea.
How do you prepare it?
So I use about a teaspoon of tea per 8 ounces. Mm-hmm. I let it steep for 3 to 4 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then I strain it and I drink it with no milk or sugar.
Oh,
this
okay.
tea is so smooth.
I'm very excited
and
to try this
it
next
is
time
really,
I'm at your house.
It scratches all the black tea itches, but it has a bit of a malty thing going on, and it's so smooth and mellow.
Do you strain it through a chinois?
Shut up. But yeah, I wanted to mention Nepali Traders. It's based in Boston. It's owned by a Nepalese couple, in fact, Sunita and Rabin Joshi.
So
I'm
we
not
can,
sure if
we
I'm
can,
pronouncing their name right.
We can definitely link to that in the show notes so you can get your own, because now I want some.
And I also feel like, at least as someone who has primarily been drinking coffee for a really long time, tea feels very affordable in comparison.
That makes sense.
I think I bought like a canister 2 or 4 ounces of this tea, and it felt very reasonable.
Okay. All right. Our producer is Abby Circatella. We plugged our stuff last time and a few times before that. We're good.
Mm-hmm.
But please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Oh, you know what? We need to refill our mailbag. If you got any questions for Spilled Mail, send them to me at contact@spilledmilkpodcast.com.
Great. Thanks for listening to Spilled Milk.
The show that that cleans itself constantly while recording.
No, but let's keep it. Okay. The show that's
been cooking sous vide for the last 30 minutes at a balmy 78 degrees. things went so well last week when we tried to do the closing joke.
I was going to try to do something with spherification.
Okay, let's hear it. Let's sphere it.
I'm Molly Weisberg.
And I'm Matthew Hipster Burton. Bye.
Nailed it. The show making a roux between your ears. Gross.